You depend on reporters to let you know what's happening. In an emergency, the first thing you do is tune in somewhere for information so you can protect yourself and your family. Radio, newspaper, and web journalists keep you informed and ready to take action if you need to. But times are changing for journalists. People are getting suspicious of reporters. President Donald Trump refers to the press as an enemy of the American people. Now there's talk about a new McCarthyism and a threat to American democracy. Can you feel it? The political climate is changing. The press is trying to adapt, but we have tough questions to answer. Are journalists focusing too much on Trump's tactics and too little on the substance of administration policy? Ever wonder how much news coverage is dedicated to what's going on outside of Washington's political circles? Michael Massing is a reporter and former Columbia Journalism Review executive editor. He recently wrote an article for The Nation in which he challenges journalists. It's titled "Journalism in the Age of Trump: What's Missing and What Matters." Michael, so good to have you on Midday. By the way, we have a link to your article on our page.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So what's not being covered with the Trump administration? What's missing?
Well, you were putting your finger on it in part. There's such an obsessive interest in Trump, which is natural, that at the same time, so much is sort of overlooked. I mean, the amount you can pick up the New York Times or the Washington Post and find numbers of pages devoted to Trump and the in and out of policy, who's in, who's out, the state of the White House staff, who's the next departure. Meanwhile, so much is going on in the country and the world that I feel is often missing. I mean, we could get into talks about what needs to be reported more, but I mean, cable news also, you turn it on. I mean, I was just watching this morning, you know, whether it's CNN, MSNBC, Fox. I mean, this just concentration, this narrow casting on what's going on in Washington and every little give and take. And
it almost seems like noise after a while.
People, I mean, they actually, you know, obviously are getting a lot of people watching, but I wonder how people manage to keep hearing the same thing over and over. And I watch these cable networks and I think, could we see one story about something going on in the rest of the country that's not linked to the president and his fortunes? And it's, you can go for hours and not see that.
You argue since President Trump took office, journalists have developed a siege mentality. What does that mean, a siege mentality?
Yeah. Well, first, I have to make clear, as I tried to in my article, that journalists are under siege. I mean, the president's venomous attacks are terrible and actually could lead to very dire consequences. And also the financial situation of the press is very bad. And so this has led journalists to sort of feel that they're under siege, and even at the president's recent rally, you know, constantly calling them the enemy of the people. But I feel that one consequence is that journalists themselves have developed a sort of circle the wagons mentality in which they feel so beset that they're not willing to have any discussion about the quality of what they're doing and can they improve it? What are the flaws? New York Times used to have a public editor. They don't anymore. I find even the main watchdogs of journalism have basically, they stay away from looking at the actual major news organizations and how they're doing.
So it seems what you're saying is that journalists are so under attack that they're just trying to survive and not really critically analyzing what they're doing.
It's partly survival. It's also, there's a sense of a journalist's prerogative, the First Amendment. Any attack on us is an attack on the First Amendment. And so even things where there might be actual criticisms about, as I try to point out in my article, of bias, of insularity, of groupthink. I mean, these are basically, there's no discussion that's going on now because journalists are both so feel under siege, but also they feel like we represent the public and what right does anyone have to sort of actually criticize us?
So they're not, or we are not just on the defense, but we're also on the offense. I want to play a clip. You know, at a rally on Tuesday, Trump supporters went after reporters, yelling at them, taunting at them, and especially CNN's Jim Acosta. Here's that short clip.
There is no other way to describe what the White House is doing these days. Wolf, top officials, including the president, are hiding from the press. And Wolf, just to give you a sense as to what's happening right now, you can hear there is a chorus of boos and other chants from this Trump crowd here in Tampa, Florida. They're saying things like CNN sucks, go home, and fake news. Wolf, obviously, all of those things are false. We're staying right here. We're going to do our job and report on this rally to all of our viewers here tonight.
So when you hear something like that, how does that typify what you're critically analyzing?
Well, first of all, that's a scary clip. I mean, it's horrendous how Trump is whipping people up. And one really can only hope that it doesn't lead to attacks beyond just words. So you can understand how people feel under siege. I wish, though, at the same time that journalists are standing up to this, that they look within more. I mean, I find CNN, you turn it on, and the level of, I just find it very one-sided and parochial in many ways. I wish we had a cable station that did a better job in reporting on what's going on in the country.
See, you say that, and some people could take what you're saying as evidence that Trump, maybe he's doing something right, in the sense that he's pointing out fake news, he's pointing out bias. What you're saying, obviously, you feel for the journalists, but someone could take your words and say, hey, maybe this is proof that journalism, that Trump has it right.
Well, Trump is a demagogue, and you see him constantly use it to whip up the troops. And it is making it more difficult to have a rational discussion, which I'm trying to do. Writing this article was very difficult for me because, on the one hand, I wanted to make clear that I find so much of what Trump does abhorrent and really sort of, the constant stream of falsifications and sort of racial inflections and the like. I mean, it's really, it's having a terrible effect on the country. And yet at the same time, I want our press to do better. I want us, I'm part of it, and you know, as you said, we. And I just feel like I'm being insulated from a lot of what's going on. I feel that the press is giving its readers or viewers what they want and not really bringing in more viewpoints, not getting out into the country more. So I don't want to say, the president has a point, because the idea of fake news has become a slogan, but I wish journalism itself would take it upon itself to scrutinize its performance and see where it can do better, because I feel there's a lot of room for improvement.
You wrote about press coverage of wealthy, powerful corporate leaders. You think journalists are avoiding investigating people who are strong enough to retaliate?
Yeah, I've been writing about this in a number of places. I feel that while it's open season on the Manafort's and the Jared Kushner's, and rightfully so, there's a whole world of power and money that really barely makes its way into the news. The world of the big banks, the world of hedge funds, the world of private equity, the big banks now control so much more of our economy than they did even 20 years ago. And the Times, to its credit, had an excellent article on the front page today about growing concentration in the world of big tech, in the world of the banks, in the world of other sectors of the economy, and the pernicious effects of this. But so little. I'm obsessed by the world of private equity. Most people don't even know what it is. It's an anodyne term, but you've got these companies out there that are so powerful. They're buying up companies in the country, weighing them down with debt, stripping them, selling them off for huge profits. They make the case they're making them more efficient, the companies, and maybe in some ways they are, but I feel that it's an almost invisible sector. And I tear my hair out trying to understand why there isn't more reporting on the Blackstones, the Apollos, the Carlyle Groups, and all these very powerful companies that are having huge effects in the rest of the country.
But are you saying that journalists are afraid that if they tiptoe into this field, they could be attacked or have their careers ruined? Or is it that it's so complex that no one wants to pay journalists for the expertise required to cover it?
It's complex, but that can't be the reason, because you see investigations all over that take a lot of time and money that win prizes. I think it's complicated. I've been trying to figure this out. Why are these powerful groups and industries not covered in the way that they should. I think, first of all, journalists want access. They're covering Wall Street. Oh, they can get good stories if they stay on good terms with these people. I think, second of all, these powerful interests can push back. They're even more powerful than the Trump people in this way. They have lawyers. They have public relations people. They have intelligence agencies where we saw this during the Weinstein affair, how they use these groups to gather derogatory information about their opponents or even about journalists. And it can very much damage your career. They'll call up editors and browbeat them, and this journalist is being unfair to us, and so it can affect your career prospects.
And now we have companies that are more powerful and wealthy than ever. Apple, obviously, worth $1 trillion now.
And this was also addressed in this article I was mentioning, you know, the Big Five. You know, for years, the press, and particularly the tech press, coddled these companies. It was very much gee whiz coverage of new gadgets and how powerful these people were. And even years ago, I was wondering, my God, this is, you know, the role of these companies in promoting inequality and the way that young people are being hooked into the... And yet there was very little. Now suddenly there is a backlash developing. And my regret is why it took so long. Why aren't the banks after the recession, the Great Recession, were looked on as, you know, having brought about this terrible collapse, a near collapse of our economy. And now they're back again. It's like, what are their earnings? How are they earning their money? There's no looking at the banking sector, how it makes its money. And do they provide any real benefit to society?
So you're saying that journalists need to be more courageous to investigate some of the wealthy, the powerful, the people who are pulling strings behind the scenes, and not just the easy target, which in this case may actually just be President Trump.
Right, exactly. I mean, look, it's good that they are going after, you know, that they're holding Trump accountable. And I make the case in my article that they're doing it in a way that, you know, Congress is not, and the Democrats are too much in disarray. But Trump is part of a system. And I say that he's both a product and a servant of an entrenched system. And it's that system that I think needs to be looked at. And that takes more courage. The news organizations themselves are part of the structure. I mean, you know, look at who owns our news organizations. They're part of big corporations themselves. And they are all kinds of interconnecting social ties that people, the New York Times has a conference every November in which they invite these powerful people to sit with their journalists. And these forms of access ultimately have a corrosive effect on the ability of journalists to scrutinize these sectors.
We look at and we hear the vitriol that our president just spews about journalists, and then you wonder if that is emboldening normal people to attack journalists. I mean, and not just verbally or on the internet, physically. You know, in Maryland, 5 newspaper journalists were killed. Montana Congressman Greg Gianforte assaulted a Guardian reporter. Any evidence of Donald Trump's rhetoric motivating this violence?
Well, the case in Annapolis, Maryland, was pretty much seen as a deranged individual. But clearly a climate is being created. I sit on the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we've been very involved in monitoring and tracking what the attacks of the administration on the press. And it was brought up by the publisher of the New York Times in his recent meeting with Trump. The effect in some ways is most serious in other countries where the language of fake news and the like is being picked up and used by repressive governments to go after the press. So, yes, it's a very fearful thing. And the fact that Trump cannot, he's so carried away with this that he cannot see the danger inherent in these attacks. Whatever one thinks of the press's performance, it's so irresponsible to do this. And I do fear that something could combust.
And we're speaking with Michael Massing. He's a reporter and former Columbia Journalism Review executive editor, about his recent article, Journalism in the Age of Trump: What's Missing and What Matters. Michael, so the Obama administration set a record for using the 1917 Espionage Act against reporters and their sources. What mentality did journalists have then, and how is that different from now?
You mean about the administration going after journalists for, in terms of leaks and whatnot?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, in that regard, I think that what is being done now is seen in terms of going after leakers, an extension of what the Obama administration did. President Obama was extremely aggressive in going after those who leaked, and seizing records of journalists in some cases. And Jeff Sessions' Justice Department is continuing to do that. So I think, you know, in many of the stories that talk about the aggressiveness of the current administration, they point out that a lot of this began under the Obama administration.
What do you tell journalists? How do you encourage people to have faith in journalists when you're saying that journalists aren't being tough enough? And given the fact that journalists face not only retaliation, but in some instances, physical attack.
Well, as I said earlier, it's a balancing act. And I do, I always have to make clear that when I call on the press to do better and try to point out some of its shortcomings, that at the same time, one has to denounce the attacks on the press and express concern about the potential for it. I feel, though, that part of a free press is, you know, we need a discussion of how the press does. I mean, so at the same time, we need both, like, denouncing these vitriolic, demagogic attacks on the press. But at the same time, if journalists cannot have a good discussion about their own performance and how they can improve it, then I feel that's a major loss.
Earlier, you were speaking about how a lot is not being covered. Do you think the fact that so much is being left out is making people distrust journalists? The fact that you mentioned private equity, but a lot of people don't even think about private equity. Do people know what they're not hearing?
No, and I think that part of the what I try to raise in this, I did another piece earlier for the American Prospect called How Not to Cover America, and that looked more at the what was not being covered in the country at large. And I feel that, you know, in the same way that Democrats were caught by surprise and felt such shock at the 2016 result, could happen again. I feel there are forces and developments going out in the country that are not well covered. I'll give you one area: religion. Religion is such a powerful force in America. Evangelical Christianity, as we know, was a major part of Trump's constituency and remains so. Like, why is that? There's many articles written on the op-ed pages, many of them speculative. People never go out into the field. They don't go to churches or mosques or synagogues and really talk to people about the role of religion in their lives. Usually evangelical churches make it into the major press when there's a scandal or when a pastor comes out to his congregation. But actually, religious communities are such a cornerstone of American society, for better and worse, you know, in all kinds of ways. And when do you actually see people, reporters going out and just talking to people? I think that's a more general problem. Reporters need to go out and talk to ordinary people. So much of the reporting now going on in the nation is tied to the midterm elections. Who's ahead? Who's behind? What are the mechanics? Who's ahead in fundraising? You see few times voters are actually spoken to and what's on their minds, and it adds to my frustration.
So what about the question of money? At the end of the day, reporters have to be paid in order to do their jobs. Very few can actually afford to do it without being paid. And a lot of news organizations see covering religion, for example, as not a profitable source. Not enough people are going to click on that. This is a view. I don't know if you buy it, but this is a view.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. I mean, look, first of all, the New York Times has 14 bureaus around the country. They have many correspondents in the field. So it's not a matter of like, well, we'd have to pay somebody. They actually just hired a new religion correspondent. But I think you definitely are on to something. You know, more and more, sort of what people click on, the traffic, is critical to the health of our newspapers. Many newspapers, of course, outside New York and Washington, LA, are not doing very well at all. So even just fielding a basic team is very difficult for them.
Here in New York City, we had so many layoffs just recently.
Yes, absolutely. These are devastating cuts, and they have an effect on the national press because there's less of a feeder system funneling news up into the national news organizations. But I just feel, again, it's like we're blind to many things that are going on out there. And I recently, months ago, I interviewed Dean Baquet, the editor of the New York Times, and he quoted a former editor, Gene Roberts, who had this saying. He says, the biggest stories don't break. They ooze. They seep up from the ground over a long period of time. And those are the stories that you really need to find. And I feel that those are the stories that are being missed.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, because oftentimes you want to see a bleeding hand, but really it's what happens before blood is shed that's the most intriguing. You mentioned that a lot of stories in the heartland are not being covered. And there's a view by a lot of people in America that there's condescension in urban areas, and in particular by journalists, which make people, even if something is written or produced, not even want to see it anymore. How do you deal with that perception of condescension?
It's a very powerful force. It's not just journalists. You know, in the world I move in, I see it a lot. I myself sometimes succumb to it and catch myself. Watch the late night comedy shows. You know, the level of scorn that's constantly heaped on Trump and his supporters by extension. I feel it's people aren't even aware of how this is being perceived. I quote Nick Kristof in my piece, who he says whenever he writes about Trump supporters, he gets all this vitriolic mail. How can you write about these people? They're reprehensible. Basically, the deplorable idea. And he says this is a very short-sighted view. You know, you need to win people over if you want to see a Democrat elected. And expressing and mocking them constantly is not the best way to do it.
It sort of breaks your heart, because we have evidence of that view when everyone says, oh, why write about these people? They're this, they're that. But only because we have evidence do we know that this is happening. On the flip side, the people that are being dismissed, they may not be writing about it, but they're voting a
right.
certain way. That's how they show reaction to this notion that there are groups of Americans that you can look down on.
Well, I think that many of those who do look down on others actually don't get out and talk to them. And it goes both ways, of course. People in the field have their own prejudices about people in the big cities, the slickers and whatnot. and a lot of it is fed by lack of contact. And that's why I feel, you know, when you do go out into the field and talk to people, it's usually fascinating. And even, you know, racial animosities, which clearly are a major factor in American life. I mean, they're underpinned by other things that are going on in the world. And you just have to do more to get to the bottom of that, I think.
I worked for many years in the Midwest, and I noticed that firsthand, the difference in news coverage, what's important, what risks you're willing to take. Obviously, local news in the Midwest is different from national news on the coasts, but there's that difference, that friction between the two, which bleeds into politics. Now, there are some politicians in these markets who, even though they may be against Trump, they feel as if it might be political suicide to go after him.
Yeah. Where did you work in the Midwest?
Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Sort of the big political
town.
Yeah.
I mean, Ohio is itself, you know, fascinating. I've done some reporting out there as well. And I went out in 2008 to Northwestern Ohio from Toledo South. And the groundswell of populist groundswell, it just was feeling. And the trade issue was resonating. This is back during the 2008 election. And that's one of the issues I feel that was easily overlooked. And that's why Trump's tariff policy, which seems very misguided and counterproductive, and yet it's resonating with certain sectors of the population. And you don't get a sense of that if you're not out there on the ground.
You know, Roger Stone, he suggested that any politician voting to impeach Trump would be, and this is a direct quote, endangering their own life. is there a wider hostility to dissent in the Trump era?
Well, I think definitely so. I think that, again, in my, you know, my own circles, in the press, I've been fighting the sense that, that certain things, it's not like, it's like you get frozen out, you get marginalized if you dissent from the, you know, accepted point of view. I feel there's a groupthink. I use that term in my article, and you see it on the among columnists and the op-ed pages in particular.
When you say your circles, what do you mean by your circles?
Right, right. I'm sort of, you know, a New York Upper West Side person who moves. I have a lot of friends who are journalists, writers, and the like. And I sometimes find myself the skunk at the table, you know, like raising things when people do seem to be very dismissive of people in other parts of the country. And I'm not from New York originally, and I'm very conscious in a way of even though I've been here for years, of sometimes not being totally in accord with the views of the rest of the country.
But isn't that the point? I mean, you're articulate, you write a lot, you have a platform, which a lot of people don't who share your view, who actually point out these issues, but they're not afraid to be at rallies and, you know, physically go after and attack journalists because, hey, you don't hear me. You don't see me. I am here.
It's an interesting thing. I've thought, like, so if journalists did get out more, would it sap some of this anger that's out there? And things have reached such a pitch, and Trump is so determined to sort of inflame and exploit the sentiment out there that it's a very volatile time. So I'm not sure journalists can slake that. But I just feel in terms of the profession itself and how well it does, it needs to really step things up. And we need a discussion more about how we're doing and how we should do better.
If we could look at the corporations, you mentioned this private equity. The Supreme Court ruled spending money is protected speech and that corporations actually have some of the speech rights of individual citizens. You think that's altered how journalists work now?
What do you mean exactly?
So if it used to be that if someone speaks up, they are protected by their freedom of speech rights. But now companies, these corporate
citizens,
actually have some of these rights.
Well, I mean, I think it's a bigger social issue. It's the way that the First Amendment, this happened over a course of 20 years. Like the tobacco industry claimed First Amendment rights when it came to putting warnings on cigarette boxes and the like. I think it's had a very negative effect on society that corporations and money, it's the role of money. The Supreme Court basically has taken the position that there should be no infringement, you know, no limitation on what one can say based on how much money you have. And we're seeing the effects now in terms of the polarization going on. And one of the reasons why these big corporate and financial interests are not being scrutinized properly is they have so many resources. So it's not just using the First Amendment. It's using an array of helpers in the legal profession, the public relations profession, and even just their sort of social connections. It's political giving. It's extraordinary how they have remained invisible in spite of their tremendous power. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracist, you know. It's like, I mean, these people have a right to say what they think, but from a journalistic standpoint, I'm just sort of constantly scratching my head on why there isn't more on these sectors that have such power in the world today.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Michael Massing. He just wrote a piece about journalism, the age of Trump, what's missing and what matters. So given the fact that despite negative perceptions of reporters, despite the whole notion of fake news, in an emergency, when you have doubt, one of the first things you do is tune in somewhere to get the news. What are we supposed to do with the fact that journalists are under fire? How are we supposed to engage media and journalists? Everyone listening sort of wants that answer.
Well, do you think that people listening to this show are generally upset with how journalism is behaving? I don't know. As I said earlier, I think that a lot of people, you know, basically news organizations, the model more and more is giving your readers what and viewers what they want, and listeners in this case. It used to be advertisers were the main support for journalism, and that of course had its own constraints. Big companies, real estate interests, whatnot, could exercise some degree of restraint on news organizations. Now it's the subscribers to our newspapers, it's the viewers and the ratings, and so more and more you have news organizations tailored to what people want. For those who are unhappy, I don't know. How big is it? I wonder.
How big is the unhappy population?
Yeah, yeah. Or? I mean, I'm saying, like, let's say we talk about the top news organizations and not the people Trump's addressing. How about people, you know, who listen to WNYC or read the New York Times? Are they basically satisfied? It's too bad we don't have call-ins on this show. I'd be interested in seeing what people would say and whether they might disagree with me. They might be, in fact, happy with plenty of people in the circles I move in think the New York Times and Washington Post are doing a superb job, which in many ways they are. I mean, they are a line of defense against the deluge taking over. But boy, I just see a lot of room for improvement.
And there, it's a line of defense that you say, obviously, people need to get stronger because something is missing.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining us. So it's excellent work that you've done.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for joining. I'm Duarte Geraldino. I've been speaking with Nation magazine contributor Michael Massing about his cover story, Journalism in the Age of Trump.